The past two speakers have focused on the promise of health system reform. Our next speaker can tell us about the realities of reforming the delivery of health care and public health services at the state level. John Auerbach was appointed the Massachusetts Commissioner of Public Health in April 2007. Under his leadership, the department has developed new and innovative programs to address racial and ethnic health disparities, to promote wellness, including the Mass in Motion campaign, to combat chronic disease, and to support the successful implementation of the state's healthcare reform initiative. Prior to his appointment as commissioner, Auerbach had been the executive director of the Boston Health Commission for 9 years. He's a personal friend of mine, a great public health leader, probably very familiar to many people in this room, and I'm very much looking forward to John's unique insight into the experience of both being a public health commissioner implementing state-level health reform and the lessons that he sees for all of us in implementing national health reform. John?
With left foot, great. Good morning, everyone. And it's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much, Dr. Eitan, and wonderful to see you, and Dr. Benjamin, thank you very much for your leadership and incredible leadership at APHA. And I also just want to say what an honor it is to be on the same platform that Dr. Koh was on. And Dr. Koh, thank you for your extraordinary leadership in the country, and very proud to have learned from you as commissioner in Massachusetts. Thank you. And to the Surgeon General, thank you for your compassion and caring and insight into what we need to do to merge public health and clinical care. I'm going to talk this morning about what our experience has been like in Massachusetts in the implementation of our healthcare reform initiative, which is about 4 years old now. I think that it might offer some insight into what some of the challenges as well as the opportunities are that arise from the successful passage of the Affordable Care Act. In Massachusetts, as I said, about 4 years ago, we passed a healthcare reform initiative, the goal of which was to achieve as close as possible to universal health insurance. The idea behind it had many different components, but it required that all Massachusetts residents had to have health insurance, that employers with 11 or more employees had to have coverage for health insurance, and that there needed to be an insurance exchange, what you heard Dr. Koh talk about earlier, the Commonwealth Connector, to create affordable private insurance packages for people and then offer opportunities for those individuals to connect to that insurance. As in addition to that, subsidized insurance was expanded significantly. So what happened? What do we see after 3 years of implementing this? We've seen a dramatic decrease in the percentage of people who are uninsured in Massachusetts. Now, admittedly, we started in a better place than many states. Before our health insurance initiative, we had approximately 7% of the population who were uninsured, so already a relatively low percentage compared to other states in the country, but we dropped it dramatically to less than 3% as a result of the implementation of our health reform, and that meant almost overnight hundreds of thousands more people had access to health insurance. This chart illustrates two aspects of what we found. One was that we saw significant decreases in the percentages of the population that was uninsured across different racial and ethnic populations. So as you can see from the blue bars, in both white, black, and Latino, we saw reductions in the percentages who were uninsured. But the second point to take away from this chart is that the percentages of people who were likely to be uninsured were greater in the black and the Latino community, both before and after our health reform initiative. That's worth paying attention to both in terms of who's likely to benefit the most dramatically and the work that will still continue even after many of the initiatives are in place. And just as a reminder that Massachusetts is a little bit different and in terms of the impact that the National Affordable Care Act will have on us, it won't be quite as great as it is in other communities. This is a chart that illustrates the percentage of uninsured in Texas, just as to look at one state. And in Texas, about 25%, a little less than 25% of the population lack insurance, with a higher percentage of the Latino population lacking insurance. So around the country, we're seeing a more significant need to provide healthcare access to the populations that are vulnerable. So what have we seen? Well, this offers some examples of what we've seen by looking at who saw a doctor in the past 12 months. And as you can see in Massachusetts, in the total population, we're doing pretty good. We have almost 90% of our population now that say in the last 12 months they saw a doctor. Now, and you can see that that looks good across different age groups. When we look, however, at the insured population versus the uninsured population, we see this dramatic difference. In other words, we see that of the insured population, about 86% of Massachusetts residents now say, I saw a doctor in the last 12 months. When we look at the uninsured, that remaining less than 3% of the population, it's almost less than 50% of the population who is seeing a clinician during the same time period. And then when we look from a public health perspective, we're very concerned with preventive services. When we look at who's getting preventive services, we see a little less than 80% of the general population say in the last 12 months they received preventive services. That might be a flu shot, that might be a screening for cancer. But when we compare the insured versus the uninsured, we see in Massachusetts, 3 out of 4 people now with insurance get preventive services during the year, but only about a third of those who still lack insurance are getting those preventive services. So those include, again, things like flu shots, screening for cancer. So this is just a reminder, having that insurance card really makes a difference in terms of having access to care. Now, what we've tried to pay attention to in Massachusetts is to constantly be looking for indications that access to care really has an impact on your health. This is some suggestion that it does have an impact on your health. This was our behavioral risk survey that asked people, are you in good health, very good health, fair, poor health? And what we've seen from that survey consistently is that when people are uninsured, they're much more likely to report during those surveys that they are in fair or poor health relative to the insured population. Not surprisingly, when we ask people, was cost a factor in your getting care in the last year when you needed it? Was money an obstacle to your getting care? We see two-thirds of the people who lack insurance, even now, say to us that two-thirds say money was an obstacle in terms of their being able to get the care they needed in the last year. 25% of those with insurance still say that. So that's a reminder that the copays and the deductibles can still be barriers, but at a much lower level than for people who don't have insurance. And this is just another illustration that of the relationship to health. It's an indication that if you have insurance, not surprisingly, you're much more likely to see a dentist and get dental care in the last year. 3/4 of the residents who have insurance see a dentist in the last year, whereas less than half of those without insurance do. We looked very carefully at what changed in that first year of healthcare reform. Could we see something that indicated health was going to be affected by these hundreds of thousands of new people entering the healthcare system? We saw a few different areas, and I'll highlight those for you. We saw in that first year of healthcare reform that we saw a 7% increase in adults who had a flu vaccine. This is before H1N1, so this is seasonal flu vaccine. It occurred during the year that we were reducing state purchases of flu vaccine. And when we looked at who was actually giving people those flu vaccines, the largest percentage of that 7% increase was in a doctor's office. Similarly, that first year we saw a 15% increase in the percentage of the age-appropriate population who were getting colonoscopies. And what we thought about it for those two is it really makes sense. For the people who lack insurance, they often sought care in the emergency department when they were sick, when they had an accident. If they went in, their immediate needs were treated, but they were less likely to get a flu shot or be referred in for a colonoscopy. But we found for the hundreds of thousands of people who suddenly had insurance, they scheduled a physical, often for the first time in many years, and at the physical they would either get a flu shot, they would be referred in to get a colonoscopy if that was appropriate. And this last point also occurred, which is that if they, when they talked to a clinician about the fact that they smoked, they were encouraged to stop smoking, but also a large percentage of them were prescribed nicotine replacement therapy. In fact, what we found was Medicaid, for the first time after our healthcare reform initiative began, offered a nicotine replacement therapy initiative, and fully 11% of the Medicaid adults in Massachusetts took advantage of nicotine replacement therapy in that first year of healthcare reform. We believe that resulted in a very dramatic decrease in terms of the percentage of the population who smoked. We saw the largest drop in the adult smoking percentages during that first year, again related to the access to nicotine replacement therapy and being counseled by their doctor. This chart illustrates the percentage of decrease in smoking in the adult population in a given year, and you can see in that move from 2006 to 2007 when we implemented health reform, we saw this dramatic decrease in the percentage of the population, the adult population, who smoked. So these, I think, are clear indications that there's a direct relationship to your health and having that insurance card. But our own experience is healthcare, having access to healthcare, is a necessary condition for good health, but an insufficient one. Those of us in public health know that we also have to change the conditions in people's lives. We have to focus on the public health side of the equation in order to make sure that we're doing everything we can to maximize people's health. And I would argue that there's a very strong correlation between public health and healthcare reform. And I'm going to talk about what our experience was about the ways that public health could be actively involved in the implementation of healthcare reform. These are the three lessons, though, that I'll highlight for you. One is public health can help healthcare reform succeed. Number two is healthcare reform cannot substitute for public health. And third, public health needs to adapt, change to the new conditions created by the Affordable Care Act now and healthcare reform that we experienced in Massachusetts. So the first point, how can we help it to succeed? I believe that public health professionals and activists can play a very important role in helping to design the insurance packages. And I say that after sitting at the table with the insurers as they were designing those packages and recognizing that there weren't people other than the public health representatives who were talking about the importance of prevention and talking about screening and talking about linking to the community. Here's some of the questions that only public health people raised when we were designing packages in Massachusetts. We were the only people who were raising the issues of nicotine replacement therapy. We were the only people who were talking about counseling, the importance of counseling newly diagnosed patients with chronic diseases about chronic disease self-management and making sure that those components were covered by insurance. We were the only ones who talked about community health workers and the important role that they can play in terms of being part of the clinical team and making sure that access to care exists. And we were the only ones talking about substance abuse and mental health and how important they were in terms of designing these packages. Now, that was in the beginning. Clearly, there were many other people at the table who were interested in those issues, but public health folks really zoned in on those and made sure that those questions were being considered in a thoughtful way. We also became the strongest advocates for understanding how copays and deductibles could concretely become obstacles to people accessing certain care. Another important role for public health in terms of healthcare reform is measuring the impact of reform on health. there will be a tremendous amount of attention that's focused on looking at how many people have health insurance and looking at certain of the service benefits within insurance components. But I believe, and I think many of you believe, that what we have to do, if we're going to make the case that the Affordable Care Act is an incredibly important act to retain, we have to show how it's having a short-term impact in terms of improving people's health. Public health people are good at that. We're able to look at those health indicators through surveys and through other mechanisms, and we need to retool our survey mechanisms so that we can come up with that evidence as quickly as possible. This is a small chart that we developed to look at some indicators where we saw changes in the first year of healthcare reform. We needed to get that word out to people about the impact that would have on health. And those of us in public health can also fill important gaps that remain even after people have insurance cards. Here's a few examples of that. Even when we talk about universal health insurance or near universal health insurance, many people won't be covered, and we have to recognize that and think about how do we provide services for those individuals. In Massachusetts, we've got the lowest percentage of adults without insurance in the country, but we still have probably 125,000 adults without insurance, and we're unlikely to get to the point that they have insurance. And so we need to think about the services that they need from a public health perspective. Secondly, some services have historically been provided by public health outside of the clinical primary care service delivery approach, and those include tuberculosis services and medications. They sometimes include STD services. We need to determine where and when we need to continue those public health activities and where it's realistic and conceivable that they actually can be folded into primary care and medical homes. But we can't lose sight of the fact to make sure that they're continued until those issues are resolved. And sometimes we can do things like purchase childhood vaccines and other vaccines at low cost that make it more affordable to distribute those vaccines to providers throughout our municipalities. The second main point that we've learned is that healthcare reform can't substitute for public health. This is a really important issue because the Affordable Care Act, and in our experience in Massachusetts, healthcare reform was expensive. And so people who are elected officials look for ways to cut other programs, and they try to think, well, what can we stop doing now because we're now doing healthcare reform? And unfortunately, they sometimes decide to cut sharply into public health, and they sometimes cut in areas that don't make sense and will create harm. And so we need to be on our guard about that. One area that's critically important that public health excels in is prevention. And here we're not talking about preventive services, preventive clinical services. We're really talking about population-based services and changing the conditions of people's lives and in their communities. So one example of that we have to attend to is addressing the percentage of the population that's overweight and obese and the serious clinical conditions that result from that. Massachusetts isn't different than other states. 60% of our adults are overweight. About a third of our school children are overweight. That's resulted in Massachusetts in a doubling of the percentage of the population with diabetes in just a little over 10 years. So we are doing things that are the public health approach, that are corollaries to what should be happening in a clinical setting where people are being talked about their weight and what they can do. We're changing the conditions of their lives so that it's easier for the healthier behavior to be the easier behavior. Those include things like menu labeling for fast foods. We passed a regulation to implement this. California passed a law. New York City did. And now, thanks to the Affordable Care Act, this one will become a national law. And in the coming year, we will see those restaurants posting calorie labels in those chain restaurants. That can be very important. If we educate the population about the appropriate amount of calories to have, and they now have this tool to help them make wise choices. In schools, we passed a regulation in the last year that mandates that body mass index is measured on children and confidential, and it's done in a confidential thoughtful way, with care, with the information directly conveyed to the parent, along with a packet of information about what parents can do to promote wellness with their children. We've actively been working with employers to incorporate wellness programs at the work site, and we're working very closely with communities to, at the local level, to make sure local health departments have the tools they need, and mayors, in conjunction with the local health departments, can work to change foods in the schools, create new zoning incentives to get fresh fruits and vegetables into the poorer neighborhoods of the city, redo transportation systems so they emphasize bikes and pedestrian walkways and not simply automobiles, but changing the conditions is key. And we've done lots of education about this. Now, there are actually, we've seen some dangers if we don't do this, if we don't fight for the continuation of public health funding, in fact, for its expansion, we actually can see some serious problems that result. In Massachusetts, for example, the first year of healthcare reform, the legislators were looking for ways to cut, and they cut some areas which created problems. They cut our tobacco control program. And they said, well, people have insurance now. They'll get nicotine replacement therapy from their provider. We don't need to have a public health insurance program. What we found was, in fact, nicotine replacement therapy was available for people on Medicaid, but not in those private packages. I couldn't convince the private packages that they should cover nicotine replacement therapy. The insurer said to me, why should we invest in something that is going to create savings for Medicare, not us? So we're not going to cover, we're not going to have that as a benefit package. And so we had to go back to the legislature and say, false assumption, we've got to have the public health component of tobacco control for a variety of reasons to complement what's happening in clinicians' office. We also saw a $50 million cut in childhood immunization funding for public health because the assumption was insurance will just pay for that. We had designed over the years a universal immunization program for children in Massachusetts that had great cooperation with pediatricians. We were in danger of losing that very effective system because the legislature was understandably thinking they didn't need to pay for that anymore. We were able to successfully have those funds reintroduced, and we now have continued to have this very effective childhood immunization program. A second example involved cuts to family planning. Again, legislators looking for cuts said, well, family planning must be covered by insurance. Let's cut all those publicly funded family planning programs. We then went to the family planning programs and said, was their assumption correct? Are your clients, in fact, insured, and are they willing to use their insurance card? And then we looked at the data they presented us. A third of the people using family planning services were part of that 125,000 people I mentioned didn't have insurance. They were actually using family planning services as primary care in some ways. So the intent was not to have them no longer have access. Another third were teenagers whose parents often had health insurance, but they weren't going to tell their parents that they wanted to get family planning services. That's why they were going there, so that their parents wouldn't know that they were seeking reproductive services. So again, the intent of cutting the funds by the legislature was not to deprive these two-thirds of the clients from getting services. We were able to bring that data back to the legislature, and luckily the funds were restored. But it perhaps provides to you an illustration of some of the struggles we may be facing as we work through what will occur and won't occur as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Here's another unintended consequence we had to work on. We, like every other state, had the Women's Health Network wonderful programmatic funding to provide breast and cervical cancer screening for uninsured women, a great program. We had more than 15,000 women every year who would take advantage of that. The first year of healthcare reform, the number of women in the program plummeted. Why? Because as they came in to get their screening, we signed them up for insurance instead. We thought that would be better. But later in the year, when we went back and talked to some of the women, what we found is fewer of them were going in for mammography screening. And the reason was the copay. The copay or the deductible was a barrier they didn't have before with Women's Health Network, where it was free. Now, that wasn't the intent of the people in our state who passed health care reform, but it was a barrier that now existed for those women who said, you know, if I've got to pay $50, I need that $50 instead more for rent or for food, and maybe I'm not at risk for breast cancer. Very fortunately, in the Affordable Care Act, that problem was addressed because preventive services like mammography screening were protected. And specific language is admirably in the Act to say that those services should not have to pay copays and deductibles. And that's an indication of just how wise people were in crafting the bill. I would say, by the way, we had great support from leadership at the Centers for Disease Control and other federal officials in the Obama administration as we talked through over the last few years what we were learning about these programs and how we needed to rethink some of the federal funding that we were receiving. So just an incredible willingness to be supportive. So the third point is public health needs to change. As a result of healthcare reform, we need to do the things that we did before, except where we're seeing very clearly we can scale those back because of healthcare coverage, but that needs to be evidence-based. We don't want to make those presumptions unless we're sure that will happen. But we need some new emphasis and some new skills. One of the things we need to do is we need to get to the table. And I would share with you that around the country, as states are pulling together the teams that are looking at who's going to respond to Affordable Care Act, often the Medicaid folks are at the table, the division of insurance is at the table, but we need to make sure that public health is always at the table. Both the state officials and the local health officials need to be at the table to really help to make sure that we're taking the full advantage of the potential of the Affordable Care Act. We also need to pay greater attention to being able to demonstrate concretely and specifically that prevention works in terms of saving money. A lot of decisions are going to be made based upon our being able to demonstrate cost savings, not over the course of a lifetime, but in a relatively short amount of time. I spent the last 4 years sitting at insurance tables where people will only take me seriously if I can put forward proposals that talk about a return on investment, and there we're talking money, within a 2-year period. We can't always demonstrate that, but sometimes we can, and we need to make sure that we're going out of our way to do those studies that are going to give us that evidence. One example, you heard me mention earlier that people were dismissing my talks about nicotine replacement therapy, the insurers were, because they thought, you know, John, this is going to create lung cancer perhaps, but it's going to be 15, 20 years from now, Medicare is going to be the one who's going to be paying for it, we're not. So we did a study looking at our Medicaid data of what was the difference between the population taking advantage of the smoking nicotine replacement therapy, giving up smoking, versus the smoking population on Medicaid that wasn't in the first year after they took advantage of that benefit. And we found short-term, statistically significant savings in such things as myocardial infarction and other medical conditions. So we were able to put a price tag to that, and I could go back to that table and saying, hey, no, it's not just Medicare who saves. You'll save in 2 years. Here's some data that should be useful to you in terms of making those actuarial calculations that are going to be a part of designing what the insurance packages include. We need to reassess our service models in public health. Over the years, local public health and state public health has often filled the gaps in terms of providing critical health services, immunizations, STD services, TB services. We're often the primary care provider in a number of different locations because nobody else filled the gap. And now at the state and the local level, the county level, we really have to reassess what's the implication of many of those people that we serve having health insurance. How do we either transition out because other providers are now interested if there's an insurance source, or do we become more expert at developing reimbursement systems ourselves and fully capturing the third-party reimbursement? We have to take this really seriously, and it will be helpful for us. One example, in Massachusetts, we never used to bill for tuberculosis services in our public health clinics. We started doing that a couple of years ago. It was an incredible cultural shift. But what we found was that the patients often had insurance cards, and they didn't mind being asked for the insurance cards if we did it in a sensitive way that made it clear if they didn't want to give it to us, didn't matter, they'd still get the services. What we now find in many of our clinics, the majority of patients are willing to have us bill third-party insurers, and we're able to diversify our funding base for the long-term provision of some of these important services. But it's a cultural change, because historically, public health didn't do that. So this is again related to what I was just mentioning. We also need to show that public health people are good at cost savings. We're not always able to do this. They often look at us in public health and think, you just want us to pay for something new that we didn't pay for before. But we actually can be very skilled at demonstrating that we can improve quality of care while costs are reduced. I'll offer some examples. We can be very useful in terms of working on this issue of hospital-associated infections or healthcare-associated infections that Dr. Koh mentioned, or serious reportable events. These include medical errors of different types or just bad occurrences. They include such things as a patient falling while in the hospital, they get out of bed in the middle of the night, and they fall, break a hip, and then that has to be treated. Many of those conditions can be prevented, not all, but a number of them can. And what we found is public health people can be actively involved in helping to make the changes to make those savings. We did a study that showed that $400 million a year was being spent in Massachusetts on treating hospital-associated infections, and that therefore we could improve the quality of care. No patient wants a hospital-associated infection. No hospital wants one to occur. And reduce cost if greater attention and expertise was focused on this particular issue. And so we paid, as public health people, to have specialized infection control nurses who were working with hospitals, consumer-oriented education programs so that patients were saying, did you wash your hands? Are you really paying attention to not spreading infections in the hospital? And then also hospitals were brought together for educationals at the Hospital Association and Medical Society, and there were conference calls that were held on a monthly basis, and we're seeing a difference as a result. Now, just as an indication how you can go further, the legislature then passed a bill that said, we think that this is showing a lot of promise. The bill said, hospitals can no longer bill for the costs associated with treating a preventable hospital-associated infection or a preventable serious reportable event. No billing. And who's going to decide whether it was preventable? The Department of Public Health. So we're now involved in screening for those events for the insurance companies about when the clinicians, the insurer, the hospitals can no longer bill for those procedures. No hospital wants any of these to occur, but they have a lot on their plate. Elevating this issue to a higher level by creating an additional financial incentive makes it a higher priority, and we're seeing, again, we can be helpful in terms of pointing out best practices. We're also very active in the determination of need or certificate of need process. What we found in this process is that part of the high cost of healthcare is sometimes healthcare facilities are built that are duplicative and not needed. Sometimes new technology is developed that is effective, but we don't need to have three of them in a community. We only need one of them in a community. And public health folks are very skilled at screening for use and need and can be helpful in determining when unnecessary costs are being added to the system. So we've had a shift back to regulation in public health as part of healthcare reform so that we can look at this, the cost implication of building new facilities. That sometimes these new fancy facilities actually cause problems because they'll pull patients out of community hospitals that need a range of different patients in order to survive and offer services. So again, new roles for enhanced roles for public health, but important in an age of healthcare reform. We've also become active in looking at the costs associated with the unhealthy influence at times, not always, of pharmaceutical companies on physician practices by putting in place some additional barriers to inappropriate connections between pharmaceutical companies and physicians that may influence decisions and drive up costs. And so we're now involved in collecting information about the donations that are made by pharmaceutical companies to doctors, and they're on a transparent website. Affordable Care Act also addresses this issue and creates new transparency in terms of those relationships. So, what can we expect? Well, my experience in terms of healthcare reform is it's neither nirvana nor hell, but it's a challenge. It's a wonderful opportunity. The Affordable Care Act will offer us great potential, much, much more good than we've ever had before in terms of offering access to care. But there are also challenges, and public health needs to adapt to those challenges. We have to make sure we don't lose ground in public health because of these false assumptions, and we have to make sure we're adapting to ensure that we're taking advantage of every opportunity we can to work together with clinicians and to work at a community level focused on social determinants so we're maximizing the health of the population in the country. Thanks.
And do we have any questions for John? Yes, we do.
Hi, Chris Haftery, National Institute of Nursing Research, NIH. Thank you very much for your presentation. I couldn't agree more with everything that you said. My one question is, right now, there is a focus on whether or not we should be using, for example, cost-effectiveness research. It has all of a sudden taken a hit. The DAX panel people did, it was almost like Monty Python, actually, coming in death, death, death. And I have to say that there's been a real pullback, and everybody's kind of being exceptionally tentative about whether it's okay to use cost-effectiveness analysis. And clearly, you're advocating that we should be looking at what works, what doesn't work, and how much it costs. I think we have a moral imperative to make decisions that also, we first look at the outcomes in terms of clinical, and then we look at the costs. And it is possible to actually have prevention pay, but there's a whole side up there that we're gonna have to fight against. So if you could address what you think the strategy would be now that we're basically on the line. Are we going to just call it something else? We're not allowed to use qualies, so.
Well, I would say that our experience is once we address the issue of access, or we got to near universal, the issue of cost and cost effectiveness was the issue we had to start grappling with. One thing I wanted to mention was healthcare reform in Massachusetts is not controversial. We just had a hotly contested governor's race in Massachusetts. Healthcare reform wasn't discussed. People in Massachusetts support it, as Dr. Coe indicated. It's very popular on both sides of the aisle, a Republican, Democrat, even independents. We're saying, yes, we're not going to touch this. But everyone is concerned about the cost of care and making sure that we're not paying for duplicative care, we're not paying for unnecessary care, we're paying for high quality care that's really going to be, we can demonstrate is going to be effective in terms of the outcomes we want. So I'm hopeful that as we expand health access through the Affordable Care Act, other parts of the country will see the need for that as well.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Jane Oski, I'm a pediatrician and public health practitioner on the non-philanthropy nations in Arizona. Thank you for your presentation. I recently received a press release from the Physicians for a National Health Program reporting that in a recent survey of 1,000 members of the Mass Medical Society in a workforce survey, that a plurality of the physicians surveyed said that they now support a single-payer option, as opposed to only 17% of state physicians who would support a duplication of the Massachusetts model. They don't talk about what percent supported a single-payer health plan prior to implementation of the Mass model, but I'm curious to have your thoughts on what this means for health reform on a nationwide basis, and whether or not there was ever any consideration of a public option sort of policy when you were leading up to the development of the Massachusetts program.
Sure. I think in terms of the the history of the Massachusetts program was, I think there was a thought that there was certainly discussion about that. I think part of what it takes, I think, to get everyone to the table to agree on passing it is give and take and consideration of the different forces that you need to cooperate in order to actually get something passed and implemented. And so what we have is really what we could do. And so I think what we're doing right now is, given that, and given the fact it's not a single payer, it does have this diversity, but it has a very large subsidized public component to it, there is the capacity for that component to help to drive some of the decision making, and at the same time drive down some administrative costs that I think have been seen as the negative side of a non-single payer approach. So I would say we are seeing that there is some indication of growing support for single payer, but the focus right now in Massachusetts is really on demonstrating we can make this work, continue to show that it can work, and provide high quality of care while we're really controlling those costs. So, thanks.
We're going to go to noon, which is the change of the schedule on the questioning, and then it will go from noon until 12:30. For lunch, and then the breakout sessions will be at 12:30. So just so that people know, we're a little bit off schedule here.
Hi, I'm Sherry Weingart from Chicago. I teach at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois Chicago, among other things. I teach a course in public health management called Public Health Resources Management, Methods, Ethics, and Policy, so that when I teach people how to do cost effectiveness and what you can and can't say about a situation based on cost effectiveness, very much integrated with that, we measure the ethical impact and talk about the ethical import, et cetera. In other words, both and, not either or. And I am hoping that, and I do this because I have some faith that, that this can be a way to have the discourse. But I want to tell you that, you're very polite and you may have alighted over some differences, or at least maybe it's different in Massachusetts. I used to work in Boston, but in Illinois, people really do hate family planning, the people who hate us, okay? And there's no, and people really do want, are very understanding of the, we're putting this long horizon issue before you in order to trick you, not because we're having like an honest disagreement. And so I want to say that number one, we need to remember that even to get to this point, as wonderful as it can be, we've given up a lot. We ceded public option. We ceded all sorts of things. And it's been great here. Okay. So that we're already compromised to a certain extent. That's reality, and we're adults. But the contemporary reality with that is that there is a big lie being, very consciously perpetrated, with very elegant propaganda by all the interests who were arrayed against us even getting this much. They did not sleep, they worked. And we have commercials in Illinois showing the woman with a shopping cart down the road saying, nobody's gonna tell me what, if I can buy soda for my kids. Don't, that's taxes. So, everybody needs to understand what we know about big lies, and it's just repetition that lays in. Okay, so if we are going to have to go forth and talk in glowing terms about how we retain the good stuff here, how we not see anymore, I think we have to be realistic about the strength of the forces arrayed against us and be very strategic, and I hope we can do that, I was hoping for that in this session, about how we because some of these people will support us, but only so far, and we need to have the both and discussions.
Thank you for that comment. Thanks.
Over here.
My name is Margaret Walkover. I'm the director of Wellness, Recovery, and Resiliency for a large public behavioral health care system in Northern California. And I do have a quick question. Just a statement as background, we know that healthcare reform is going to bring in a huge number of people into the Medicaid system. We know that a very large percentage of those people have mental health and substance abuse challenges, and we know that those are very expensive. And within the public mental health community that deals with this population, we also know that having programs and supports that deal with the social determinants of health will really bend that cost curve. Talking about wellness supports and self-help programs and all those other sorts of things in addition to the medical care. So I'm wondering, where you are in Massachusetts, how you've dealt with the social determinants of health within your healthcare reform, and if you have any kind of model that kind of mirrors what's being talked about as a healthcare home. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
My part of my perspective on what I think we've learned is that we need to have complementary systems. We need to have good medical homes, and we're increasingly focusing our attention on the concept of a medical home, where people get a wide range of different services provided to them, including the behavioral services, frequently as possible in a comprehensive healthcare delivery unit. At the same time, we are increasingly committed to the notion of doing focused efforts that are both population-wide and population-specific around social determinants of health. And so if we've got the clinicians, say, in a particular practice who are seeing elevated diabetes rates because of overweight and obesity, we want to make sure that they can talk to us and talk to the local health folks about the barriers that their patients are facing in terms of actually following some of the recommendations to eat fresh fruits and vegetables, exercise more, because barriers in their community. There aren't supermarkets that sell those products at affordable rates, or the parks aren't safe. And how can we work together? So we're striving for the model that says those two approaches, the public health approach and the clinical approach, need to be complementary, and we need to think about ensuring there's quality clinical care, but that we are creating these conditions which are less likely to create some of these behavioral issues if we can design them well. So this is our aspiration. Whether or not we can get there, I think the devil's in the details. And we think that the fact that the Obama administration, through the Affordable Care Act, is also looking at community transformation grants and other funding mechanisms that will allow communities to create, allow local and state health departments to create efforts that can be community-wide, changing the conditions. We think that that makes sense at the same time that we're expanding those insurance options and making the connections. So, we're working with that's the vision, and collaborative discussion and planning is what we've been doing over the last couple of years.
Don't be doubtful, I believe we all can do this.
I'm sorry?
Don't be doubtful, I believe that we have the resources and the people and the leadership in our communities. We just have to have the right strategic collaboration to get this work done.
Yeah, yeah.
On behalf of these folks that are struggling, we can do it.
Great, thanks.
My name is Deborah Stamen. I work for the Public Employees Federation, which is a public sector labor union in the state of New York. And I have a couple of not so public health oriented, but healthcare reform questions for you.
Okay.
We are about to enter into contract negotiations, and we're very much aware that healthcare reform is going to influence some of the negotiations. And my questions are, when you went through this transformation in Massachusetts, number one, how much did employer premiums rise, if you know? And number two, color negotiations, and of course negotiations are different from one employer group to another. And we are facing, as you well know, a new governor who is publicly not being friendly to the unions, but we are in a terrible budget situation like many states. And I am one of those people who's going to be sitting at the table and dealing with this in health benefits negotiations. So anything you can share along
sure.
those lines.
Sure. So, I mean, one thing I would say is unions, particularly the public service unions, were incredibly important in helping to shape our healthcare reform initiative and in helping to make sure that it could be successfully implemented. So I think there was really a partnership with organized labor in Massachusetts in terms of thinking this through. Premiums had been going up for years. In Massachusetts, healthcare costs are higher than they are in a number of parts of the country, and the level of increase each year was, you know, pretty steady. We didn't see a leveling off or a change in terms of the slope one way or the other after healthcare reform, and the last year, maybe 2 years, what we've really been honing in on is what can we do. Now that we've kind of addressed the access issue to, you know, pretty good degree, to begin to rein in those costs. So the governor, our governor, took very dramatic action this year. He refused to approve the insurance company's proposed premium increases. He just said, not going to do it. They all came in with double-digit insurance increases, and you know, some of them like 15, 16, 20%. And he just said, I'm not. They're all rejected. The first time it had happened, they sued him, very contentious. But they also came back to the table, reworked things, and now most of them have come back with much lower increases. So that's one step. I think there really needs to be that attention and leadership like we had with our governor. Another is our focus now is really on the issue of payment reform. And what can we do in terms of creating a new way of reimbursing for healthcare that's not fee-for-service, that may create clinical outcomes as the driving force and pay for clinicians to figure out how to provide high-quality care that get those clinical outcomes with global payments of some sort. We're working out the details to accountable care organizations that then will allow us to begin to level off the growth in terms of the cost of healthcare. That we're focused on that intensively. I now go to many more meetings than I ever thought I would in public health to talk about payment reform. But I think it takes that kind of a focus. And frankly, we couldn't have done it before when we were focused on the question of increasing insurance access to people. Now we can focus much more on this issue. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to work on driving down those costs. I don't know if that's helpful. So.
Thank you.
That's it. I'm going to have to apologize to the people that are waiting in line. We have to move into lunch. And I have to tell you about what's coming up next. First of all, I want to thank John for just an excellent presentation.